That's the Quiet Beatle, George Harrison, and the cover of an old Hoagy Carmichael song. Hoagy Carmichael, the composer, not Hoagy the sandwich. You ask your grandfather about that. The Devil in the Deep Blue Sea, which came off his posthumous album Brainwashed from 2001. And that's, George Harrison loved Hoagy Carmichael. He used to just wander around his palatial estate with his ukulele singing Hoagy Carmichael tunes all day. What a life. Who really murdered Mary Pinchot Meyer in the fall of 1964? And why was there a mad rush by the CIA counterintelligence chief, James Jesus Angleton, to locate and confiscate her diary? Had Meyer finally put together the intricate pieces of a bewildering conspiratorial mosaic of information that revealed a plan to assassinate her ally and lover, President John Fitzgerald Kennedy? And was it mere coincidence that Mary Meyer was killed less than 3 weeks after the release of the Warren Commission report? In his book, Mary's Mosaic, The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and Their Vision for World Peace, Peter Janney draws on years of painstaking research and interviews, much of it revealed for the first time. Janney traces the most important events and influences in the life of Mary Pinchot Meyer, including her exploration of psychedelic drugs as a protege of Timothy Leary and her support of her secret lover, the President of the United States, as he turned away from the Cold War toward the pursuit of world peace. The 50th anniversary, actually the 53rd anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination and the 52nd anniversary of Mary Meyer's, has come and gone, but their deaths remain a haunting harbinger of America's fall from grace. Peter Janney on the murder of Mary Pinchot Meyer when Coast to Coast AM continues. I'm Richard Serrett. Peter Janney grew up in Washington, D.C. during the 1950s and 1960s. His father was a high-ranking CIA official and a close friend of Richard Helms, James Angleton, and Mary Meyer's husband, Cord Meyer. A graduate of Princeton, Peter is a clinical psychologist who lives by the sea in Beverly, Massachusetts. He's the author of Mary's Mosaic, The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and Their Vision for World Peace, now in its third edition. Peter, welcome to Coast AM. It's good to talk with you again.
Good morning, Richard. Good to be here. Great to be here with you and your listeners at 3 a.m. East Coast time.
Yes. Well, God bless you for staying up late. I gave a very sort of a thumbnail sketch of Mary, but this was Mary Pinchot Meyer, really a woman of substance. You know, you can call her a socialite, and she was an artist, but there was so much more to this woman, and you knew her. Your families were intertwined. Tell me more about Mary Pinchot Meyer.
Well, your description of her is absolutely correct. You know, Mary grew up in a very progressive, aristocratic family in New York City. You know, her father, Amos Pinchot, was one of the co-founders of the American Civil Liberties Union. Her mother, Ruth Pinchot, was a left-leaning journalist. And so from a very early age, both Mary and her sister, Toni, were encouraged to become individuals, that is, to explore the meaning of what it meant to have an independent self. And so they were given quite a bit of latitude for exploration. They were also classically educated, I think both of them. Well, Mary went to the Brearley School, a very well-known posh girls' school in New York City, and then went on to Vassar College. She actually was in the same class at Vassar as my mother. So when the CIA really got underway, a lot of these families, you know, moved to the Washington area, and Mary and Cord Meyer and their family was very closely located geographically to where we lived. And I became almost instant friends with her middle child, Michael. We went to school together. Our desks were side by side in the classroom, and we just, you know, had a ball with one another. Unfortunately, Michael was killed in an auto accident when we were both 9 years old. And this event, for me, really precipitated a very significant grief reaction. And ultimately, the only person who could reach me in a way that I needed to be reached was not my parents, but Mary Meyer herself. And so I, you know, after Michael's death, I spent, you know, periods of time at the house, at the Meyer house. I would wake up in the middle of the night crying sometimes, and Mary would console me. She was just an extraordinary human being.
And it's very telling. It's very telling, Peter, because
any other adult of that right. era, in my experience,
it's very telling. You know that you obviously she was grief stricken. You were grief stricken, and yet she comforted you. There's a story that when Michael was killed, I guess on a curve, a bend in the highway near their home. The driver that struck Michael was obviously and understandably out of his mind, and the story is that while her son is dying en route to the hospital in the ambulance, she's also comforting the driver.
That's correct.
Is that remarkable?
That's correct. That was a quality of Mary's capacity for intimacy. You know, she really. Already at that young age had developed herself. She had a presence about her. You know, when you were even as a boy, when you were around her and you talked to her, you always had the feeling that she was listening to you and would respond to what you're saying. Unlike, you know, most adults of my parents' era, where basically, you know, children were to be seen, not heard.
Right. And in your relationship with Michael, her middle son, your best friend, his death, was that not sort of the impetus for the divorce between Mary and Cord Meyer? Did that sort of not get
well?
That, kind of...
that actually, that event actually brought Cord and Mary back together closer. Because, you know, they shared in the grief of the loss of one of their children. But Mary's disenchantment with Cord was really had much more to do with what he was doing at the Central Intelligence Agency. Your listeners have to remember that, you know, when Cord Meyer came out of World War II, he was wounded on Guam. He came back. He'd lost an eye. But he really went through a profound moment of confrontation with himself where he realized that, you know, he was a pacifist at heart. And with the beginning of the nuclear age in 1945, Cord realized that, you know, another world war just could not be allowed to take place because it would be catastrophic in terms of what it would do to the planet. So Cord kind of became a rock star in the late 1940s for this movement called the United World Federalists. They were trying to set up a structure like the UN that would function as a sort of world government organization to head off, you know, military conflicts around the globe that, you know, could conflate it and become disastrous. So Cord, you know, really gave his heart and soul to this movement. He went around, lectured at colleges. A lot of women had pictures of him on their wall. I mean, he really did have kind of a, you know, short-lived rock star status. And of course, Cord and Mary were the post-World War II peace couple, and you know, very dashing. Both very good looking, and it was, you know, it was a moment in post-World War II history. Unfortunately, when the movement started to peter out in the late 1940s, Cord's father got him an interview with Alan Dulles, and that's where Cord's downfall began.
And became the hardened Cold War warrior. That really sort of surrounded the Kennedy administration.
That's right. But people really need to understand that Alan Dulles was probably one of the closest things to pure, unadulterated evil that we have in our recent history. I mean, Alan, he seduced my father as well. I mean, he was bringing together a lot of these wealthy Ivy League post-World War people who really wanted to change the world and were idealistic and, you know, the CIA was going to be part of the vanguard in terms of bringing democracy to the rest of the planet. And it was a sham. It was really all about control and domination. And, you know, of course, post-World War II, the United States emerged as the global power. And they were not going to let go of that easily.
Back to Cord Meyer for a moment.
Sure.
Was he? I have read where he was perhaps the principal operative behind Operation Mockingbird, which was the CIA program to infiltrate and influence the mass media.
That's correct. He actually inherited that role from another CIA legend, Frank Wisner. He took over the job from Frank, and really, you know, was very, very successful in infiltrating all mediums within the media, you know, television, print media, newspapers, magazines, and of course the CIA was famous for planting stories that would start to shape public opinion in a particular direction. At one point, I think, in the early 1960s, they had as many as 3,000 CIA employees working on various journalistic inputs. So this was, you know, sort of the beginning of how the entire national security apparatus would in a sense infiltrate the media. And if we jump ahead here to 1981, where we go to William Casey, the CIA director at that time, at the very first meeting, or one of the first meetings in the Reagan administration, Casey was there, and he uttered something that one of the other participants jotted down. And what Casey said at that meeting, and I'm going to quote it, he said, quote, "We'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false."
Indeed, yeah. Those words continue to echo across history. Peter Janney is with us. The third edition of Mary's Mosaic is now available to readers. The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and Their Vision for World Peace. So Mary really found herself, what would you call it, within a den of vipers. I mean, she's surrounded, her husband has become a Cold War warrior, Cord Meyer. She's friends with James Jesus Angleton's wife, I believe. James Jesus Angleton, there's a name that keeps popping up, whether it's Marilyn Monroe or, you know, one of the head covert, head of covert operations in the CIA.
Counterintelligence.
Counterintelligence, thank you. Also good friends with the Ben Bradley and his wife. I guess at that time he was with Newsweek, but later, of course, would be the publisher of the Washington Post. What an interesting circle, but I suppose ultimately deadly.
Yes, I mean, you have to remember that all of these people more or less come from the same social class. They are all highly well educated, mostly at Ivy League schools. I mean, they socialize together, but they are really sort of the social elite of Washington, D.C., and of course, the guard dogs of American power. So yes, Mary was right in the midst of it. I don't think that was any accident, as we'll probably get to. You know, she really was the muse for both Cord Meyer first and then John F. Kennedy. And
yeah, how did she and Jack meet?
New, you know, subject matter.
How did she meet John F. Kennedy?
She met Kennedy in the winter of 1936 at the Choate School. JFK had graduated from Choate in 1935, and he initially went to Princeton, but he was in and out of hospital his freshman year. And I think in sort of in his convalescence, he sort of lost a lot of his social grace. And so when he got out of one hospital stint, he wanted to go back and start socializing, and he decided that he would go to his prep school tote in Wallingford, Connecticut to the winter festivities weekend, which, you know, that wasn't uncommon. They had graduates who would come back and would want to attend the event. But it's a big hullabaloo, you know, that women come up and are the dates of various, you know, chotis, as we say. And that is where JFK first laid eyes on Mary. Mary was the date of William Atwood, who was 2 years behind JFK. Atwood, of course, would become Kennedy's ambassador to Guinea during his administration and be very helpful to JFK as he secretly tried to create a new rapprochement with Fidel Castro in the fall of 1963. So, you know, the seeds were being planted. But when Mary first met JFK, then she was sort of, okay, I see this guy's a wealthy playboy. I'm not really interested in that. And already, you know, Mary is very intellectual. She's, you know, looking for men who, you know, have a mind and are independent thinkers. That wasn't JFK at the time, but they did remain friends. They did remain acquaintances all through college. But it's not until the late 1950s where a real relationship starts to gel, you know, as JFK is beginning his campaign in 1960 for the presidency.
And during his time as a senator in the 1950s, and of course that famous tour of Southeast Asia, when he really started to formulate a lot of his ideas about how the world should work and what America's role should be in the world, and of course talk about a den of vipers or a den of wolves, I suppose. He comes into the Oval Office surrounded by this national security state apparatus, and in many ways he was like a lamb being led to the slaughter. How much of his initial sort of ideas about maybe even the impetus to tour Southeast Asia, how much of that came from his friendship with Mary?
I don't think at that point a lot of it did. What we forget about Kennedy, because his presidency was so overshadowed by various scandals, and, you know, he had a real sexual addiction going on. We forget what a great visionary leader Kennedy was, and that he was terribly smart and an independent thinker. And so he wasn't easily swayed by, you know, what generals in the Pentagon were telling him or other national security officers. You know, he wanted to see the evidence for himself. So he took it upon himself to, you know, really examine, for instance, what was going on in Southeast Asia. And, of course, one of the big things that would have happened had he lived is that we would not have had the Vietnam War. He was on his way out of Vietnam in the fall of 1963, and that was very clearly laid out in his National Security Action Memo number 263. I mean, he was going to get 1,000 troops out by the end of 63, and the rest were coming out by the end of 1965. So that was really clear, and of course, within 48 hours after his assassination, Lyndon Johnson has reversed that order. So that begins to show you some of the forces that were behind JFK's demise.
All right, we're coming up on a break here. When we come back, we'll sort of get you to walk us through the timeline of Mary Pinchot Meyers' assassination. Let's call it for what it was. It was not some random act of violence, a murder. It was a political assassination. We'll find out exactly how that played out and who was involved and exactly the relationship, the qualities of the relationship between Mary Pinchot Meyer and President John F. Kennedy. Peter Janney, Mary's Mosaic, when Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. Aretha, that's all that need be said. They are building a life-size replica of the Titanic in China. And the idea is that it's going to provide visitors with a simulation of the original Titanic's collision with an iceberg and subsequent sinking. The construction of the life-size replica has begun at a Mediterranean-themed attraction in China. The company behind it, Seven Star Energy Investment Group, said it should be completed by late next year, late 2017. The copy of the famous doomed liner will be part of the Romandice Seven Star International Cultural Tourism Resort along the Qijiang River in Sichuan Province. As well as providing a feel of what the vessel was like, the attraction will also provide visitors with a simulation of the original Titanic's collision with an iceberg and subsequent sinking. And you can read more about it in the news section, where our webmaster tonight, Sean Lattersoor, has posted it at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, more of my discussion with Mary's Mosaic, or the author of Mary's Mosaic, Peter Janney, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My name is Richard Syrett. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Syrett, S-Y-R-E-T-T. Peter Janney is with us, the author of Mary's Mosaic, the CIA conspiracy to murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and their vision for world peace. Let's just discuss their relationship, Mary Pinchot Meyer, the mistress of John F. Kennedy. At what point did it become intimate?
From all I've been able to gather, Richard, I think it became intimate in the fall of 1960. This was when Kennedy's campaign was taking off, and actually that previous summer, I believe they had an encounter out in Provincetown, Massachusetts on Cape Cod, and at that encounter, reportedly, JFK showed up to be with Mary for the day or maybe one night. He was very upset. He realized, according to one report, well, he was miserable in his marriage. And JFK said, Mary said, you know, look, you have to get a hold of yourself. You can't, if you're going to run for the presidency and conduct this campaign, you've got to keep it together. And I think it was at that juncture where she said to him, I will help you. Of course, Mary was curious about helping JFK from a number of perspectives. At that time, she had been doing her own exploration with hallucinogenic substances. She'd been out in California exploring that, particularly as an artist. And she really felt that this exploration, this phenomenon, could have a profound effect on our culture and particularly political world leaders. So Mary was also sort of thinking, you know, long range, you know, look, I failed with Cord. Cord has gone to the dark side, for a lack of a better explanation. Maybe there's something I can do to help Jack really become a great president. So I think, you know, that's when their relationship really started to become physically intimate. And of course, essentially, you know, it carried all the way through until his assassination in November of 63.
So was Mary, in fact, a protege of Tim Leary?
Yes, she was. She met with Tim several times. She would never tell Tim, you know, who she was dealing with. She just made it clear that there were a group of women in Washington who really thought that giving world leaders, powerful government figures, this experience of having a hallucinogenic experience of their own could have an impact on what would take place around the world. That, you know, that once people got a taste of what enlightenment was, they would realize the folly of, you know, their pursuit of armed conflict or their pursuit of dominance over other human beings. So there was this sort of, for lack of a better term, an LSD cell group in Washington that Mary was, you know, running with several other women.
And it has been long argued that that Leary and the whole LSD, these experiments were conducted really under the auspices of the CIA.
Well, that is really, you know, question, you know, I question that. You know, I continue to talk to people who knew Tim, who knew what he was up to, and there just isn't any clear evidence that Tim knew he was working for the CIA. He did get research grants from one place or another. I think at some point later on, he realized that research money was coming indirectly from the CIA. But Tim himself, you know, was very anti-control. I mean, he was really the champion of the common man being able to have the opportunity to raise his consciousness and to, you know, have an experience of what enlightenment might look like.
And you reveal in the book that Mary Pinchot Meyer introduced the president to psilocybin, which is an hallucinogenic.
Correct. And, you know, before they did that, you know, she did take some marijuana into the White House, which they smoked. And, of course, she was sort of watching what JFK's reaction would be, you know, with the pot, just to see, you know, whether, you know, it would be safe for him to, you know, really go deeper with a mild hallucinogenic experience. So this took place, as far as I can find out and put the pieces together, in May of 1963, several weeks before JFK gave this legendary presidential address at the American University commencement on June 10th, 1963. And a lot of people, you know, look at this speech as they call it his peace speech, but it is a decidedly very, very different speech that more so than any other president in our history has ever given. I mean, it's remarkable what JFK says in this speech. And of course, he's really announcing in that speech that he is turning away from the Cold War and he is turning toward world peace initiatives, and that he is going to do that as an ally with Russia. And so this was a huge, huge moment in his political experience as well as the country's.
How much of that speech, that vision for world peace was very difficult to say, I suppose, but how much of it was informed by tripping out on psychedelics in the White House, smoking pot with Mary Pinchot Meyer, and just Mary's influence?
Well, obviously that's a fascinating question, and we'll never know the real truth. It's not that JFK was not already realizing that he had to do something very different. I think your listeners have to remember that in the preceding fall, we had something called the Cuban Missile Crisis, where, you know, this was arguably the most dangerous moment in all of human history. We came so close to a nuclear catastrophe, right to the point, Richard, where had it occurred, you and I would not be having this conversation today.
That's right. And as tense as it was, people didn't even really understand until decades later how close it really was.
Yeah,
I mean, it was
right.
Tense.
We didn't learn until 29 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis. We learned for the first time that not only did the Russians have medium-range ballistic missiles in Cuba, they also had 102 battlefield nuclear weapons, 80 of which were cruise missiles with Hiroshima-sized warheads. And the Russian commanders in Cuba were told that they had permission to use these tactical weapons if a U.S. invasion were to take place and they could not contact Moscow. So, I mean, just remember that the Pentagon brass was just clamoring for an invasion. They were clamoring to, you know, just bomb the hell and invade Cuba immediately, and had they followed through on that, we would have been looking at a thermonuclear disaster, which would have, it would threaten the very existence of life on planet Earth. It would have created a global catastrophe.
So,
go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, when Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense under Kennedy, found out about this 29 years later, he appeared on Larry King Live to talk about this, and he was in tears, literally, because he realized what the stakes had been and that we narrowly escaped a catastrophe of just unimaginable, unspeakable ramifications.
So when Ted Sorensen, Kennedy's chief speechwriter, is writing these words that Kennedy would deliver in June of 63 at American University, did Sorensen, I don't know if you had conversations with him
yes,
at some point.
Yes, I interviewed Sorensen.
Did he have a sense that maybe he was writing Kennedy's death warrant, as macabre as that may sound?
No. I mean, this was a speech that Sorensen was writing, but he was going back and forth with JFK on it in terms of, you know, what JFK wanted to say. But this was really a defining moment for Kennedy and what his presidency would be about. I mean, you've got to remember, during that speech, I mean, he basically confronts all American citizens and essentially all human beings on the world, saying, look, if you want peace, you have to look within yourself and see what is blocking peace within yourself. And, you know, he really let go of the Russian bashing that had been going on, you know, telling people, look, no one suffered more loss during World War II than Russia. I think they lost 23 million people. You know, we lost, I think, barely over 200,000. Just to give your listeners an idea of just what the cost to Russia of that war was.
Right. And still, that speech that he delivered must have been the final straw for the Cold War warriors, the Dulles brothers, the McCords, and others. That must have been for them the final straw. They must have said, we have lost control of this guy.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. And you know, during the speech, Kennedy announces that he's going to create a limited nuclear arms treaty with Russia. And less than 3 months later, Richard, the Senate ratifies this treaty, all of which was constructed behind the backs of the Pentagon and the CIA. I mean, this was just unheard of in terms of what he did. And then, you know, we have... You know, in September, not only does the Senate ratify this treaty, but the Kennedy goes to the United Nations and he proposes at the United Nations that Russia and the U.S. go to the moon together. He then, in November, writes this incredible another National Security Action Memo, number 271, to James Webb, who's the head of NASA, and he's ordering Webb in this memo to begin planning for a joint lunar landing with the Russians, because JFK knew how symbolic it would be if Russia and the U.S. went to the moon together and they had a successful exploration there. That would have been the ultimate symbol to the end of the Cold War. Now,
how
there's
much
another
of this is...
little caveat that I think your listeners would also enjoy about this venture. On the same day that Kennedy writes this National Security Action Memo on November 12th, he also sends a separate memo to the head of the CIA telling the CIA that he wants all the UFO intelligence files affecting national security to be shared with Russia. And this was yet another pin in the voodoo doll of death for JFK. I mean, the CIA wasn't about to give up any of these kinds of secrets needless to say, to the Russians of all
I can't
Im- people.
Can you imagine if WikiLeaks existed 50 years ago?
Oh, my God. It would have changed the course of history.
I want to bring it back to Mary Pinchot Meyer. How much of this information was shared with Mary? We all know about, you know, the missing diary, that red book belonging to Marilyn Monroe that quickly vanished after her demise. Of course, Mary Pinchot Meyer also had a journal. How much of that information do you think was shared with Mary? What was going on, sort of the back channels with Kennedy and Khrushchev and so forth?
I think probably, I dare say, all of it was shared. You know, Mary was one of JFK's chief allies starting in 1963. I mean, he came out of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was very upset. He was depressed. I think, you know, this is the time where Mary really moved in closer and said, Jack, you have got to change tack here. You cannot pursue this Cold War agenda. It will kill all of us. It will kill life on this planet. And so this is where JFK, I think, really begins to realize that he has to do something very different in his presidency. And the other thing to remember is that he's also developed this kind of friendly allyship with Nikita Khrushchev, the Russian premier. I mean, Khrushchev also knew how close we came to World War III over the Cuban Missile Crisis. He sure as hell didn't want to continue in that vein. So the two of these world leaders, the two most important political and powerful political leaders on the planet at that time, had decided to come together and begin a entirely new trajectory to world peace. And so this is what we see starting to take shape all through 1963. Also in the fall of 63, there's this secret rapprochement going on with Fidel Castro in Cuba. He realizes that Kennedy is very sincere and wants to change, you know, all the ill will and bad blood that has taken place. This is, you know, where JFK has staked his reputation. He is going to be the peace president in the fall of 1963. And of course, the national security apparatus will not allow this to take place.
Right. Now, we didn't know, the world didn't know about JFK's relationship with Mary Pinchot Meyer until the National Enquirer revealed it in 1976. You know, that newspaper gets a lot of heat, but oftentimes, you know, they get the story right.
Stories. Exactly right. You know, but, I mean, in some ways it you know, it's a rag, but you know, there have been, you know, a number of instances. I think they were one of the first people to get the O.J. Simpson story right, but they certainly got this story right, and it really created a big problem back in 1976. You know,
the actual relationship with JFK and Mary Pinchot Meyer, how many people knew about it then?
Well, I would say her good friends, Anne and Jim Truitt, they certainly knew about it because Anne was supposedly going to safeguard her diary. I think Ben Bradley, even though he says he didn't know about it, he did know about it. And I think there might have been one or two others who did, who were, you know, sworn to secrecy.
All right, we will we'll delve into that a little bit further, and also we will get around to that timeline of Mary Pinchot Meyer's assassination. And we'll talk some more about that journal as well. Peter Janney, Mary's Mosaic, the third edition. Here are the Bee Gees taking us into the break with a beautiful song, I Started a Joke, right here on Coast to Coast AM.